I'm Ernie Smith. This is number 0409 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0409. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, one of the all-time favorite movie moms, actress Dee Wallace, talks about working on the set of E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
I loved him. He had a gentleness to me in his eyes, and to work with him was really like working with another actor. They kept him alive all the time for all of us. It was kind of a weird experience because I had worked with a lot of special effects, but you couldn't really call E.T. a special effect. He was kind of like a castmate in a very strange way. I really took to him right away, as I think the kids did.
Randy Ray, co-author of As the Years Go By, Conversations with Canada's Folk, Pop, and Rock Pioneers.
I don't think you can pin a sound per se on Canadian music. I mean, we've got our folk stars, we've got our garage bands, we've got R&B, pop, heavy rock, we've got it all. I think a lot of Canadian performers get very nationalistic in their stuff, at least they did years ago. I just think we cover all genres, we do it very well. Canadian musicians have elevated Canada onto the world stage all over the place, you know, writing, performing, managing, producing, the whole bit.
Nathan Hirsch, owner of FreeUp, shares tips on e-commerce and e-marketing.
The biggest mistake that people make is not diversifying enough. Some people will open up an eBay store or an Amazon store or even their own website, and they'll be completely dependent on that marketplace. They won't ever look for other sources of revenue, or inside their business, they'll be focused on one supplier. And if that supplier ever cuts them off, their entire business really goes down the drain. And then on the hiring side, they'll hire one person to do everything, invest a lot of training into them, only to have that person take another job off. So it's really important that you're really diversifying in every single way.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0409 was Ernie Smith from Tedium. You occasionally hear him on the show. He has a great website. You can check out his excellent newsletter by going to tedium.co. And, of course, you'll find the link on the Stuff File page just waiting for you to find. And thank you very much, Ernie, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We have an update to a story that we shared with you last fall. You may remember the story of Lawrence John Ripple, the 71-year-old man who said he robbed a Kansas City, Kansas bank so that he could get away from his wife. He blamed his actions on depression. Well, this past week, a federal judge has sentenced Ripple to, wait for it, 6 months of house confinement and 50 hours of community service. Ripple went to the Bank of Labor, a block from the Kansas City, Kansas police headquarters last September, and gave a note to a teller saying that he had a gun and demanded money. After he was given money, Ripple waited for police. Court records indicate Ripple wrote the robbery note in front of his wife and told her he would rather be in jail than at home. The Kansas City Star reports Ripple told the judge Tuesday that heart surgery left him depressed and unlike himself before he robbed the bank. Wow. So he has to stay home in his house for 50 hours of confinement, actually 6 months of confinement and 50 hours of community service. It's that 6 months of home confinement because, you know, the wife is still there. Isn't that against the Geneva Convention in some way, shape, or form? Those dinner conversations for the next 6 months should be pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. Well, we have another item here that deals with marital strife. 57-year-old Robert Ahorner apparently just to win an argument with his wife, who was dissatisfied with their sex life, left the room with his 9mm semi-automatic and fired 4 shots at his penis. As he said later, if I'm not going to use it, I might as well shoot it off. Of course, he missed, and police in Elkhorn, Wisconsin said no laws were violated. Does the police response actually prop up his wife's claim? This is a classic example of the evidence wouldn't stand up in court. And in a lawsuit filed against an allegedly retaliating former lover, Columbia University School of Public Health professor Maddie Hornig said her jilted boss tried repeatedly to harm her professional standing, even twice calling her into his office, dropping his trousers, and asking her professional opinion of the lesion on his buttock. Oh, I would have just told him that looks like it's cancerous, and I think you're going to die. Let him worry over that for a little bit, for a while, huh? Yeah. And while we're on the topic of behinds, a Florida city said a former employee stole money to get a butt lift. A Gainesville City report release said Natwena Clark stole $93,000 from the city, using $8,500 on the cosmetic surgery. The Gainesville Sun said the report shows the 33-year-old Clark also used city money for her cable television bill, food, highway tolls, a television, and other expenses. Clark was fired shortly before she was arrested last March 28th and charged with larceny and scheme to defraud. She has pleaded not guilty. And now that the story is out, she is the butt of all jokes. Let's hope she has a good workout regime to keep that tush in fine form in prison. 46-year-old James Peltier was arrested in Hollis, Maine in May after he fired a BB gun point-blank at his 2 sons, aged 9 and 11, but only, he said, as a rite of passage into maturity, perhaps thinking the experience would help them become as mature as their own father. He said if the kids knew how it felt to get shot, perhaps they would not be so quick to fire their own guns. To which I ask, why would they have their own guns? But I digress. I also would like to know, at this point, if 46-year-old James will be allowed to keep his guns, or for that matter, keep his kids. Oh yeah, and by the way, happy belated Father's Day. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you know, in the business of journalism, one has to be careful, very careful, when disseminating information to make sure that you don't get too far ahead of the facts. Still, there are times when you can leap to a generalized conclusion. In a tweet posted by the Jackson, Mississippi Police Department, they said, JPD on scene of suspicious death investigation. What made them suspicious? They had only found the victim's head. Now, hours later, a body without a head was found. Police exercised caution in a follow-up tweet saying, working to confirm if linked to this morning's discovery of a human head. Now, the reporter at a local television station was similarly cautious. The cause of death for the lone head, she reported, at this time, appears to be severance. Really, Captain Obvious? Really? Yet, there is no apparent cause of death of the decapitated body at this time. Really? Don't want to go out there on that limb, do you? Well, at least there are still limbs. Ooh. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? This month features a major anniversary in cinematic history. It was 35 years ago in the summer of 1982 that we first enjoyed the wonderment that was Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial. One of the stars of the film was Dee Wallace, who played Elliot's mom in that classic feature. Dee joins us back on the show right now to talk about that film and also to bring us up to date on what she's been up to these days. She joins us now from California. Hi, Dee.
Hello, darling. Good to be back.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. So, 35 years, time really does fly. I want to go back to when you first got the role of Elliot's mom in that movie. I guess no one really knew what was going to come of this movie when you were shooting it. But did at any point during the production of that film, did you think, you know, this has the potential of being something special?
Oh, I knew that when I read the script. I knew the script was incredibly special, and I remember exactly calling my agent and saying, look, I don't know how much this is going to do for me personally, but I think it's going to do a lot for the world, and I definitely want to be a part of this film.
Now, during the shooting of the movie, at some point, because one of the mysteries, of course, with that film when it first came out is no one really knew what E.T. looked like until you actually saw him in the film. But you were working on the movie itself. So when you saw E.T. for the first time, what did you think?
I loved him. He had a gentleness to me in his eyes. And to work with him was really like working with another actor. They kept him alive all the time for all of us. I don't know. It was kind of a weird experience because I had worked with a lot of special effects, but you couldn't really call E.T. a special effect. He was kind of like a castmate in a very strange way. So I really took to him right away. As I think the kids did.
It's one thing to know that the film is going to be special after you read the script, and there are blockbusters, and then there are blockbusters. We're talking about a movie which back in 1982 was made for $10.5 million and went on to earn $359 million domestically, $619 million worldwide, and was the biggest money-making film for a decade before Steven Spielberg's own Jurassic Park eclipsed that in 1993. What was it like holding on to the tail of that comet as it was taking off?
Well, it was obviously wonderful. I mean, it's what every actor kind of prays for, is to be involved in not only a blockbuster movie, but a blockbuster movie that changes the world that they can be really proud of. And I was, on all accounts. E.T. was, people are still coming up to me telling me stories of how that movie has changed their life. And I think it's just a movie that transcends that veil of something like The Wizard of Oz and Peter Pan, and it tells us the truth, and it makes our heart remember the truth, and it lifts us up. And I think it will be here for a long, 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 long time.
It's interesting you bring up movies like Wizard of Oz and the like, because, of course, that was an earlier time in film, and no one really knew how long-lasting film was going to be at that time. But now that we have foresight, because of films like It's a Wonderful Life movies like The Wizard of Oz, we now know that film will be around forever. So what does it feel like to know that long after we're all gone, there will be people watching you in E.T.?
I love it. Who doesn't want to live forever? Come on. And I love the fact that my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and their children at some point in their lives are going to sit down and go, you see that lady? That's your great-great-great-great-grandma there. I love that. That really touches my heart because I'm a big family girl, So, I think it's great that millions and millions of people will see me, forever, but it really means more to me to think that people in my own family that I will never meet can come together and celebrate me and remember me and celebrate the movie and kind of bring the family together through that. I love that.
Mm. One last question about E.T. before I get to some of the other things you're working on, and that is you mentioned earlier that you saw the script and saw how great it was as a script. You didn't know if it was going to do a lot for you personally, but it was going to do a lot for as far as the story was concerned. What did being an E.T. do for you personally when you look back at it?
Well, it did a lot for me professionally. I had done a lot of good work, and had been recognized for my work, but not in the way that E.T. brought me forward into mainstream acting. And she's here, and she's viable, and she's talented, and she ain't going anywhere, you know, kind of thing. I mean, I had gotten a lot of wonderful accolades for 10 when I played Mary Lewis, which led to The Howling. But, you know, none of those films captured the entire world like E.T. So it did a lot for my career. I mean, I don't think it changed who I am at all, because I was just always taught, you know, to hold on to who I am and live the values that I was taught growing up. So I was always very careful not to let any of that success go to my head and change my life personally. But of course it changed my financial life, and it changed my viability in the industry, so that I could walk into pictures like Cujo and would get okayed to do that.
You mentioned you were a person of heart, and one of the things that proves that is a little bear that you brought to life a little while ago, Bupalupaloo. We talked about it a couple of years ago when you were on the program, but bring us up to date with what's been happening with Bupalupaloo.
Well, some really exciting things I'm happy to say, and Bupalupaloo has now gotten out all over the world and just have some amazing response from children with autism and mothers writing me going, you know, Dee, my kid came in to take a bath tonight. He's 2 years old, and he looked at me and said, Mommy, I love my body, which is one of the statements that the bear says. And, you know, all of this is based on brain science and teaching your kid to really create a knowing within themselves about how powerful and how beautiful and how wonderful they really are. And it's my passion project. I mean, I have my radio show that's on every Sunday, and my 5 books that I've written on creating your life consciously, and I'm doing a show for Amazon Prime called Just Add Magic. We're in our 3rd year now, and have a couple of great films coming out. But Bupalupaloo is kind of my little passion project, because I truly know and believe that if a child can really understand and own the power of how special and amazing they are when they're little, we won't have to go to therapy so much when we're older.
And we should mention, for those who didn't hear when you were on with us a couple of years ago when you first started this, Bupalupaloo is a plush bear that talks, right?
Yes, it has 10 really empowering statements, like, I love my body and I am so loved. And we encourage the parents to, you know, teach the child to push the paw and hear a statement, and then to say the statement back to the bear, which helps create the pattern in their brain, so that when a bully comes up to them, you know, and says, you're ugly, they automatically have within them that knowing of, no, I love my body. And they can, you know, they can call on that little gold mine of their own so that they can empower themselves. And then the other paw, you can record your own message in. And a lot of the kids are choosing to put their own message in. I had a dad email me that his son was mildly autistic and was very challenged making friends. And so he recorded in there, I have a lot of friends. And, you know, a few weeks into, and the dad said, you know, he plays it every night. He plays it every night. And a few weeks in, he came home and just with this big, huge grin and said, Dad, I think I have a new friend at school. You know, so I would like to think that my little bear had something to do with breaking open that resistance that was in him, that fear or that shyness or whatever it was, so that he could experience that in his life.
This brings it back full circle, because it's your nurturing personality that brings this bear to life, and it's your nurturing personality that makes you a great movie and TV mom, even when you're playing a Vesson, by the way, on Grimm.
Indeed. I had a great time on Grimm, for sure. But yes, she was still, I don't care, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to support my son no matter what he's doing.
Also, a couple of weeks ago, we had the pleasure of having your daughter on the program once again.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
Gabrielle Stone talking about her film, It Happened Again Last Night. She wrote, starred, and directed that movie. And so I asked her the question on your behalf. I'll ask it again. I said, when are you writing a character for your mom that you two can play opposite each other?
Did she answer that?
She said she was working on it. She said she was going to work on it.
We have a wonderful writer involved with us. We have the story. He's put together the pitch deck. And, that's our focus in the next year, is to get this script done and get it financed and do it together.
Excellent. Dee, it's always a pleasure to talk to you on the program. I love chatting with you, and continued success with all you do. And happy 35th anniversary for E.T.
Thank you, darling. May it live forever.
Actress Dee Wallace, one of the stars of E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and also one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. She also brings the bear Bupalupaloo to life. And again, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this week's show number, which is show number 0409, and you'll find links to Dee's site and also to that lovable little bear. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship. Or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the history of Canadian music. Plus, we'll learn some tips about e-commerce and e-marketing from the owner of FreeUp. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and is also a listener-supported, fan-funded show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Now, for those of you who love stories of governmental overreach, this one is for you. 76-year-old Harry Kramer, owner of Sparkles Cleaning Service in London, Ontario, was alone in his SUV recently and decided to light up a cigarette based on his 60-year habit, but was spotted by smoke-free Ontario officers and cited for 3 violations. Since his vehicle was registered to his business and the windows were up, the cab constituted an enclosed workspace. It took a long legal fight, but in May, the Provincial Offences Court cut Kramer a break and dismissed the tickets. Yeah, you know, smoking can be a disgusting habit, but also a disgusting habit, having to deal with a nanny state. Yeah, that can be a disgusting habit too. A burglary of a Silicon Valley tech company netted $30,000 worth of equipment, including computers. The thief was easy to track down, but not because he was injured in the break-in and left blood and other DNA evidence at the scene. No, it was because the target was Romby of Santa Clara, California, which makes GPS tracking equipment. There is no power switch, said a Romby spokesman. It's always on, and it always tells you, as long as it's got a battery, where it is in the world. The company simply relayed to police where the 100 trackers were located, and officers raided two locations, finding not only the stolen trackers, but various other stolen goods from other burglaries. A suspect is now in custody. It's great we don't need a high-tech tracker to know where he'll be for the next 3 to 5 years. And you know, if it's your desire to steal GPS tracking computers, it almost begs to make you the idiot of the day, but I didn't in this case. That comes later on the program, so stay tuned. Okay, already trendy restaurants have offered customers dining experiences amidst roaming cats, and in one bold experiment, owls. But the Art House San Francisco Dungeon has planned a 2-day experimental rat cafe for those who feel their coffee or tea is better sipped while rats, from a local rat rescue, scurry about the room. By the way, why is there a need for a local rat rescue? Anyway, pastries are included for the $49.99 price, but the rats will be removed before the food comes. Sponsors promise at least 15 minutes of rat interaction, and the price includes admission to the dungeon. Do they play the soundtrack to Willard or a Muzak version of Michael Jackson's Ben over the sound system, too? I'm assuming there are no rats on the menu, but are you sure? Are you really sure? Anyway, Winnipeg County, Iowa engineer Lee Bjerke said he had no idea how the driver of the loaded 18-wheeler had missed the load limit 3-ton sign at the entrance of a small rickety bridge near Cresco in May, but in seconds the span was wiped out and the tractor trailer had become part of the Turkey River. The loaded grain truck weighed more than 30 tons. That's 3 with a 0. 30 tons is a lot more than 3 tons, regardless of whether you're talking imperial or metric measurements. Perhaps as far as the driver is concerned, it was kismet that made him fall into the Turkey River. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Spencer White of Saugus, California, wanted a DeLorean ever since he saw Back to the Future, and he finally bought one. That led to a ride in the car with his mother on a freeway. After merging, White saw that his speedometer read 85 miles per hour. I thought, let's take it up to 88 miles per hour, he said. I only have 3 more miles to go. Right after he hit 88 miles per hour, he didn't see flaming tire tracks, but he did see flashing lights of a California Highway Patrol cruiser. After pulling over, a smiling officer approached the car. He asked me how fast I thought I was going, White said. He admitted his speed, and the officer then showed him the radar gun that he had him clocked at exactly 88 miles per hour. All of us started busting out laughing, White said. Despite the fun, the officer still issued him a ticket, but did ask him if he had a flux capacitor in the car. Maybe if I had a flux capacitor, he would have let me off, White said. Well, maybe if you had a flux capacitor, you could have changed the future and not gotten caught in the first place, but I digress. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Randy Ray is an author who, along with his collaborator, Mark Carney, has put out a great series of Canadian pop culture and trivia books over the years. His latest book is a must for Canadian music fans. It's called As the Years Go By, Conversations with Canada's Folk, Pop, and Rock Pioneers. Randy joins us on the line right now from Ottawa. Hi, Randy.
Good day, Peter.
Nice to have you on the program with us once again. Always a pleasure to talk to you about the various books you put out. And again, this latest one, you have in it about 130 stories about the 50s, 60s, and 70s performers that were, I guess, basically at the founding of the Canadian music industry over the years.
Well, this is true. This is true. It's almost 150 bands. We have some performers, some managers, some promoters, all who, you know, did have a significant impact on the Canadian music industry, and still do in some cases.
From your perspective, and I'm comparing this to music from other parts of the world, certainly from the United States, certainly from the UK, with the exception of the Francophone music industry, because that, of course, based on its language, is different. In your estimation, what is the Canadian sound? And how does it differ from others?
Well, the Canadian sound, I mean, if you look in the book, it is divided up. Our book divides up the Canadian sound. So, I mean, we have, I don't think you can pin a sound per se on Canadian music. I mean, we've got our folk stars, we've got our garage bands, we've got R&B, pop, heavy rock. We've got it all. But I think, I don't know, I think a lot of Canadian performers get very nationalistic in their stuff, at least they did years ago. So, the sound, that's a good one. That's a very good question. I don't know whether I can answer that, but I just think we cover all genres. We do it very well, and Canadian musicians have elevated Canada onto the world stage all over the place, you know, writing, performing, managing, producing, the whole bit.
What was the impetus for putting this book out in the first place? Was there an aha moment where you said, you know, there isn't a book like this, we need to document, for history's sake, our music scene?
Well, it's like this, Peter. Mark Carney and I both grew up in Toronto, and this is, I think, the crucial point about this book. So we went to the high school dances when we were 14, 15, 16, 17. We danced close, maybe with the girl, in my case, it was the girl who became my wife, under the basketball nets in the high school gym. We went to the downtown pubs and heard the bands and came home with our ears ringing, and maybe we snuck an illegal beer at some of those pubs. So we grew up with the bands, and in the 80s, we decided to write a music column and track a bunch of them down. So they were in our blood. We listened to Chum Radio. We collected Chum charts, 45s LPs, so it was in our blood. We started doing the stories, and it got to the point where all these stories were done a long time ago, but they weren't in one place in one book. So that's what we've done. We've pulled all the stories together, updated them, and added some nifty tech to the story. So if you're reading our ebook, for example, and you're reading a story about Lucille Starr, who did the French song, or the Ugly Ducklings, or the Haunted, you can click and you say, well, I can't remember their song. You click on a link, and there it is. The song will be played for you. And you go, oh, yeah, I remember that song. Or you can go to their websites in many cases and get even more up-to-date information than we've got in the book. So it's part of my life, part of Mark's life, and we had to tell these stories. And the bottom line is we're trying to take the reader, which will be baby boomers mainly, back to their youth and the good times they shared.
How many of the artists that you talk about, you have, you know, the Lighthouse, the Diamonds, the Stampeders, Bobby Curtola, you mentioned Lucille Starr, the Five Man Electrical Band, the list goes on and on and on. How many of these bands are iconic to Canada, and how many of these bands and or individual artists actually became ambassadors of Canada because their music went beyond our own shores?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, iconic to Canada. I would probably say about a third of the bands in the book are iconic to Canada. I mean, the Bells, you know, they released the song Stay a While, which got banned. You got Lighthouse that had piles of hits and turned down the opportunity to play at Woodstock. You've got the Fireman Electrical Band that had the huge hit Signs. They were just on the verge of breaking up. I mean, you got Terry Jacks, who at one point had outsold everybody in the world with that song Seasons in the Sun. People love to laugh at that song. Skylark, people probably don't remember the song. It slips my memory right now, but David Foster wrote it. Skylark didn't last very long, but look where Foster went, you know, on to become a world-famous composer and writer. Just piles of bands in the book that really left a mark. Some maybe with just one song, and some with many songs.
You mentioned radio, and I got to tell you, I was in music radio back in the late 70s, and I was also an assistant music director, so there was a time period where we had to deal with the CanCon rules. And
oh, yeah.
I'd hear from some of the older programmers who would gripe and complain because they were around when the CanCon rules first came into place. And it was a catch-22 because I understand fully why the CanCon rules were put in place to grow grow Canada's music scene and make it viable in the rest of the world. But in those early days, you know, when you only had the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald and Snowbird to play, they were slim pickings sometimes, depending upon, especially if you weren't a pop radio station, but either an AC station or a middle-of-the-road station, you didn't have a lot to choose from. How important, from your perspective, in writing about these musical artists, how important were those CanCon rules for the birth of music and the popularity of it in this country?
Well, it was massive. It was massive because it got their stuff onto the radio. I mean, we do have a story in here about Walt Grealis, who played a role in that. But massive. I mean, imagine the push that it gave to music. I can't rhyme off a bunch of bands, but I know a lot of them got on the radio solely because of that, and hopefully because they were talented. But, of course, the other thing connected to that is, especially if you were in Toronto where I grew up, Chum Radio. If you didn't get your songs on Chum, you probably weren't going to make it. You know, in Montreal, I don't know whether it was CJAD, they play radio music back in the old days, but you had to get on the radio. And, you know, there was a bit of a clique that got on to Chum, but if Chum didn't pay attention to you, you know, good luck with your stuff. Good luck with your stuff. So you did the high school circuit. And that's like, for example, the band Ocean. I think it was the song "Put Your Hand in the Hand."
Yep.
They, for kind of religious song, they correct me if I'm wrong on the song, but they cut that record because they wanted to boost, have a record that did okay and boost their paycheck when they were playing school dances and community centers. Well, not only did they do that, but the song became a huge hit, went over to Billboard, near the top of Billboard, so. You know, but Benny, back to CanCon, it was fantastic. It just did work wonders for the industry.
I know you come originally, I mean, you live in Ottawa now, but you come originally from what we in the rest of the country like to refer to as the center of the universe, Toronto.
I'm a Leaf fan, Peter.
And the fact that Chum was, yes, a most important radio station as far as the country was concerned, playing Canadian music. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Big Eight in Windsor.
Well, Windsor, yeah, the big CKLW.
CKLW, which played a lot of Canadian music, which was then heard in Detroit. And, yep. And at the time, CKLW was the number one station in Detroit, believe it or not, for those who aren't aware of that. And that was a way, that opened a door for a lot of Canadian music, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And there, I'm just doing a quick search here on the wonders of computers here. They definitely, and you know, if you're right, if you got played there, you suddenly were, you know, vaulted across the border. For example, the five-man electrical band song, Signs, it made it really big on CKLW, and as I said, the band was about to break up, and suddenly Les Emerson, lead singer, writes the song. It goes big, and they're back hitting the road again, and away they go. So CKLW can take full credit, along with Les's songwriting abilities, for vaulting that band to the heights of Canadian music.
This book, your book, As the Years Go By, Conversations with Canada's Folk, Pop, and Rock Pioneers, as we here in Canada celebrate our 150th birthday this year, a timely book to look back at one of the aspects of Canada, and that is the music scene, which nowadays, I'm sure there are a lot of people in Canada who aren't even aware of some of the biggest acts in the world who are indeed Canadian.
Oh, yes, well, you're right. And like in our book, for example, just blowing my own horn here for a second, I don't know how many people would know that the drummer of Santana at one point was from London, Ontario. You've got Dominic Tarano, who was in the Mandela. You remember him?
Yep.
Played with the Guess Who and the James Gang. You've got Denny Doherty of the Mamas and Papas, Zal Yanofsky of the Love and Spoonful. And then you've got one of the members of the Young Rascals, who actually came from Ottawa. So, you know, fantastic. We certainly have played our part. But there are all kinds of little stories in the book, and there's, you know me, I'm a trivia guy. Lots of trivia stuff in the book, too. And, you know, you'll come across other stuff like Canadians, like the song I Will Serenade You by Three Dog Night was written by a Canadian. And, you know, lots of little nuggets in there that people will find and hopefully be fascinated with.
Ardeen Taylor, who worked for Motown.
Yeah, Ardeen Taylor's in the book. Now, we talked to every... Okay, there's 149 stories in the book. We talked to a member of everybody in every story in the book. We talked to, like, we didn't talk to everybody, for example, in Lighthouse, but if there's a band in there, we talked to somebody. I had a very brief conversation with Ardeen from Detroit, and also Zal Yanofsky, and one of my best interviews, favorite interviews, was with Denny Doherty, the Mamas and Papas. I mean, talk about stories he could tell. Holy mackerel.
How about Andy Kim writing songs for the Archies?
Yeah, Andy is not in the book. He's mentioned in the book, but a lot of these people, when we wrote the columns, were still out there playing. So, for example, the Guess Who and Bachman Turner Overdrive, they're not in the book because they were not off the charts and out of it when we were doing all these stories. So that's my answer on that one, yep.
That's a great idea for a book, and your books in the past have all been great. I've seen quite a few of them, own quite a few of them.
Thank you.
The latest one is called As the Years Go By, Conversations with Canada's Folk, Pop, and Rock Pioneers. Randy, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Okay, and I would be remiss if I did not say you can find the book on our website at triviaguys.com, www.triviaguys.com, ebook and hard copy, and you can find it on Amazon as well, Peter.
Randy Ray, co-author of As the Years Go By, Conversations with Canada's Folk, Pop, and Rock Pioneers. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0409, and you'll find links to Randy's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A few years ago, when our teenage son was recovering from a head injury, we struggled to find something that would help him pass the days in intensive care. Watching TV made his headaches worse. So did reading. Then, we found a wonderful little product in the hospital gift shop called Buckyballs. Our son spent hours making objects out of the little magnets, and they helped make his hospital stay bearable. Then, to our surprise, a federal agency sued the maker of Buckyballs to ban their sale. Despite warnings on the magnets to keep them away from small children to prevent accidental swallowing, the agency said no one could use the magnets, not even adults. Let's be fair, it was a clear case of government overreach, and a federal court has now overturned the agency's ruling. The court pointed out that teachers have used the magnets to model and explain physics, biology, and geometry concepts, and that benefits like that need to be considered too. So now, the magnets are back on the market. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the owner of the company Free Up. We'll talk about marketing and e-commerce. Plus, we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And of course, more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, New Jersey authorities say a driver fled the scene of an accident with a fire hydrant stuck in his car and then tossed it in the trash. Parsippany police say the motorist drove off after his car struck the hydrant and a mailbox. Police followed a trail of water from the scene to a township home where they found the car and the hydrant. The driver was found in a nearby diner. Police say 27-year-old township resident Domingo Moreno has been charged with criminal mischief, hindering apprehension, and tampering with evidence, and was turned over to federal immigration officials. Police are investigating the cause and other details of the crash. You'll notice that nowhere in this story does it mention any kind of impairment. No mention of drugs, no mention of alcohol. How do you hit a fire hydrant and keep on driving when you're stone cold sober? Yeah. A Michigan man, apparently upset because his food included onions, is jailed on charges he made drunken threats to shoot the owner of a Pittsburgh restaurant before exposing himself. 43-year-old Yuba Sharma of Rochester remained in an Allegheny County jail on charges of terroristic threats, indecent exposure, public drunkenness, and resisting arrest. Police say Sharma ate at All India restaurant on Monday night and then returned Tuesday to rant and complain about the onions. The owner said Sharma threatened to shoot him, so he called police. That's when Sharma, confronted by the restaurant owner and another employee, pulled down his pants and exposed himself. Okay, This guy was complaining about his onions from the day before. That's holding a grudge way too long. Then he decides to get naked as a form of protest. Or was he hoping someone would play a game of ring toss with him with the onions? I don't know. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Nathan Hirsch is an e-commerce and hiring expert. He started his first multi-million dollar company when he was only 20 years old and in his college dorm room. He's the owner of an online hiring platform called FreeUp, that's FreeUp with three E's, which is specialized for the e-commerce and e-marketing industries and has been selling online for the past 7 years. Nathan joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. It seems you got into this on the ground floor at the right time, but I'm sure with the knowledge you have in dealing with e-commerce and marketing industries that you still see a lot of mistakes being made each and every day. What's the most common mistakes people who are in these type of industries are making?
Yeah, so the biggest mistake that people make is not diversifying enough. Some people will open up an eBay store or an Amazon store or even their own website, and they'll be completely dependent on that marketplace. They won't ever look for other sources of revenue, or inside their business, they'll be focused on one supplier. And if that supplier ever cuts them off, and I've had that experience before, their entire business really goes down the drain. And then on the hiring side, because I work with a lot of businesses on hiring properly, they'll hire one person to do everything, invest a lot of training into them, only to have that person take another job offer. So it's really important, especially as you're getting started in year one through five, that you're really diversifying in every single way.
So the old axiom of don't put all your eggs in one basket holds true in this business as well.
It does. I mean, so when I was first starting my first Amazon business, Portlight, I was crushing. I was making more money than I had in my entire life. I had hired a manager to let me take a break and go on vacation. And my first day on vacation, I got a call from my manager saying our supplier called us and they no longer want to work for us. So within all the hours that I put in the first year or two of my company were just out the window. And it took me a good 6 months to recover. But when I did, I had the mindset to diversify. And the business was not only bigger, but it was stronger and more stable than it ever had been before.
How do you avoid the other side of the coin? It's important to diversify, but it's also important not to spread yourself too thin.
Yeah, so you have to diversify, but make sure you're putting effort into things that work. I'm a big proponent of trial and error, especially when you're looking for additional revenue streams or different suppliers. One mistake that I made early on is I just wanted to work with every single supplier in the world. So I kept these relationships going with suppliers that I wasn't doing a lot of business with. And there's a lot that goes into working with suppliers, whether it's building softwares that work with your system and theirs, or training your workers to use their website, or just monitoring how the orders get from point A to point B. So I invested a lot of time and effort into manufacturers that weren't making a difference in my company. So while it's good to diversify, you're right. You have to make sure that you're really investing the time properly where it should be.
Well, let's talk about your company that we just referred to in the intro, and that is FreeUp. And by the way, for anybody who want to check out the website, FreeUp has three E's in it. So it's FreeUp.com. Tell us about FreeUp.
Sure. So I've been hiring hundreds of remote workers. It's something that's really helped me look good and really expand my companies rapidly. But when I was hiring, what I quickly noticed is I was spending 50% more of my time just on HR reasons. I was going through applicants and doing multiple rounds of interviews. And if I needed to hire someone, it was weeks or even months at a time process. So I wanted a better way. So at FreeUp, we do it differently. We get hundreds of applicants every week. We have a great interview process based on my 8 years of hiring. We take the top 1%, we add them to our network, and we make them available to our clients first come, first serve. So our clients love it because whenever they need something, just put in a request and they have a worker ready to go by the end of the day. And the cool thing about us is on the back end, we also know how annoying and frustrating turnover is. So we have no turnover protection. If any of our workers quit for any reason, which rarely happens, but it's there to protect you, we cover all retraining, all replacement costs, and get you a new worker right away. So as a business owner, we save you time on the front end and protect you on the back end.
It sounds like this business you've created was one of those situations where, as the saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention. You created something because it was an opportunity for you to correct a problem that you were dealing with in your own business life. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And when I started it, I was very much like, hey, this is a problem I had. I was curious to see if other people had that same problem. And it turns out almost every business owner has the same problem. And the response has been overwhelmingly positive. And we're able to really make a difference. I mean, people are able to do what they want within 6 months rather than 2 years just because they're able to get access to talent quickly.
Is it fair to say that a lot of your businesses have come from a necessity point of view? For instance, I mentioned it earlier that you started your first multimillion-dollar company when you were only 20 years old in your college dorm room. What was that business, and how did you create it?
Yeah, so that was by necessity only because I was a broke college kid looking for extra beer money, but it was really by accident. I mean, I started off buying and selling textbooks because I got upset at the school bookstore that they were selling me books for hundreds of dollars and buying them back for pennies on the dollar. So I cut them off and I lined out the door of people wanting to sell me their book instead of the bookstore. And that led me to Amazon because you don't sell books for very long without learning about Amazon. And when I found Amazon, I became addicted to it and I learned everything about it and how to really maximize sales. And I had a customer service background, which fit right in, so I could take really good care of customers. And then it was all about building relationships with different suppliers and vendors that would work with a 20-year-old student. And it was a lot of hard work on that end. So before I knew it, I was drop shipping from many different suppliers and vendors. I used that trial and error approach to see what kind of products I would sell. I first thought I would be selling more DVDs and computers, but I eventually settled in on baby products, toys, and home goods, only because that's where the market took me.
Wow. You definitely were a go-getter kid. I'm assuming that at some point you started out with a lemonade stand or a paper route or both.
A lot of failed lemonade stands along the way.
Well, I had a lemonade stand and a paper route, so I know where you're coming from. So, now, what are the things you try to teach people the most when it comes to e-commerce and marketing?
Yeah, so what I like to teach people the most is that there's really two ways to hire, and hiring's everything. No one gets to reach their potential by doing it all themselves. It's just not possible. And when you're hiring, you really have to identify two ways to go about it. You're either hiring people to take stuff off your plate to get more hours back in the day, and if you do that, you really have to focus on your systems and your processes and getting them down so you can pass them over to someone else and train them quickly and make sure they can do it at the same level as you. But then on the other side of it, a lot of people go south because they might try to take a six-month course in Google Ads or how to build a website instead of just hiring someone to do it for them, and they don't realize the opportunity cost that comes with that. So I always encourage people to identify areas in your business that you can take off your plate and create processes for, but then identify areas in the business that you're just not good at, and it would be a waste of your time to become good at it. So you can hire an expert or consultant, someone who has that experience and has that background to do that part of your business for you.
For you, your personality, what are you most happy with? Are you happiest starting a company, building a company, or running a company? Because those are three different things.
Yeah, true. I don't love the starting up of the company. I've done it twice. It's a lot of work. I mean, it's fun only because I've had success doing it, but I also just know how many sleepless nights and long weekends you have working. I definitely enjoy running the company the most. I mean, the best part about FreeUp is I get to interact with 500-plus workers who are awesome at what they do, and I get to help them provide for their family and learn their stories and be a part of their life. And on the client side, I get to network and meet influencers and meet clients and help them pursue their dreams and their passions and really accelerate their business. So, I mean, that's really what I enjoy doing now, just because I get to manage, during the process of me running FreeUp, I get to meet and help all these different people from all these different backgrounds.
People can find out more information about the company and what you do by going to the website, which is freeup.com. And again, I mentioned FreeUp has three E's in it, FREEUP.com, correct? Is there any other information you want to share as to what they can learn from your company?
Definitely. If you go right on the site, it's free to sign up. There's no monthly fee. Right at the top, you can click my calendar and you can book a meeting right with me. I'd love to talk to you about your business free of charge and just see if there's a way for me to help. You can also check out the FreeUp blog, the online hiring mastermind group, and our book, FreeUp Your Business.
Excellent. Nathan, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nathan Hirsch, the owner of an online hiring platform, FreeUp. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0409, and you'll find links to Nathan's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot. of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
According to police, a Guelph, Ontario man faked being sick and paramedics were called in a ploy to get out of paying his bar tab. Late Wednesday night, the man was in a downtown establishment and consumed some alcoholic beverages. Before he paid for his drinks, he appeared to develop some medical distress, and an ambulance was called to assist him. Police were called when it was learned the same situation had occurred earlier in the evening with the same man at a different establishment. EMS staff said the man was not intoxicated and he was not suffering from a medical condition. It is alleged that the male feigned illness to avoid paying his bill, police said. The 39-year-old Guelph man has been charged with fraudulently obtaining food and will appear in court at a later date. Now, why, oh why, would you want to have yourself carted out of a restaurant on two separate occasions by paramedics on the same night just to avoid paying your bill? I mean, did you not think reports of two separate incidents would seem fishy to the powers that be? Of course you didn't. You know why? Because you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0409. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0409. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. John's Bay, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, I always screw it up.